The art of baking bread at home barely survived the 20th century. Whether for lack of time or skill, few Americans bake their own bread anymore. Well, you can almost smell the nostalgia in a new book about bread making, which suggests the secret to success can't be captured in a recipe. NPR's Dan Charles needed to investigate.
Samuel Fromartz makes his living as a writer, and he works at home on a quiet street near the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C.
Hey.
Your newspapers are piling up.
Yeah, been a little busy lately.
Not too busy to make bread, though. He usually does it a few times each week. It doesn't really take a lot of time, he says. In the evenings, he'll mix the dough and put it in the refrigerator to rise slowly overnight. The next day, when he needs a break from the computer, he'll go downstairs to the kitchen and make the loaves.
What takes time is the rising, but you're not doing anything while it's rising, so I go back to work.
He started doing this about 20 years ago, just because he couldn't find bread that he liked. Then he got a little obsessive, making all kinds of loaves. He struggled for years to make a good baguette.
I finally decided after several years that it was impossible to make a decent baguette at home.
But then he landed a magazine assignment. Go work in a bakery in Paris and write about it. That led to more bakery pilgrimages to Berlin and San Francisco, and eventually to Fromartz's new book, In Search of the Perfect Loaf. Fromartz confesses at first these trips were a little disappointing.
I was traveling thousands of miles to work with bakers. And if you've ever spent time with bakers, you'll know that they are pretty introverted. They don't make a really great interview if you're a journalist. They're the kind of people who like to work in the middle of the night listening to loud music.
He wasn't getting great stories or colorful quotes. Some of these bakers, in fact, barely spoke English. So Fromartz adjusted his expectations.
What I decided was, if I could learn one thing from any baker, the trip would be worth it.
And he did learn. But exactly what he learned is hard to put in a recipe. He saw how the bakers monitored their dough, the baguette maker in Paris, for instance.
He just would look at the dough and say, yeah, needs a little bit more water. Or the loaves would be rising, and to me, they would look like the baguettes were like really ready to go in the oven. And he looked down, and he said, 5 minutes.
He was seeing something that Fromartz couldn't, but gradually Fromartz started to see it too. And this is the thing about bread making, Fromartz says. It's not completely predictable. Each batch of dough will behave a little bit differently because the living creatures in it, the yeast or the microbes in your sourdough starter, they react to the temperature and humidity in your kitchen or what brand of flour you're using. So when it comes to the key decisions, like when to shape the dough into a loaf or put it in the oven, you have to rely on your senses.
Your eyes, you know, looking at the dough, feeling it with your fingers, just kind of knowing, I think, based on past experience, because you've made this loaf 1,000 times, what the dough should look like.
But what's it supposed to look like, I ask him. Try to describe it.
It should, I hesitate to say this, but it should kind of look alive. It shouldn't look like a stiff ball. It should look like it's kind of wanting to continue growing.
Right now, we're looking at a ball of dough. Samuel Fromartz seems a little skeptical.
I would actually prefer it if it had risen a little bit more, but it'll still make a decent loaf.
We decide to make a couple of baguettes, also a simple round loaf.
And I'll just, like, flop it down a few times. And then I just fold into the middle to stretch the exterior skin, but not compress the interior.
Fromartz works quickly, shaping the dough. He makes it look easy. The knowledge of how to do this is in his fingers. A few hours later, the loaves are done.
You know, I think it worked out. They look like you want to eat them, don't they?
They do. Let's eat them.
To me, those loaves seem just perfect. Dan Charles, NPR News.
There are people who appreciate a good meal. There are people who are really into food. And then there's Dan Pashman. He doesn't call himself a foodie. He's an eater. And he's set out on a mission to help the rest of us eat better. I'm not talking about eating healthier here. Better, as in how to get the most deliciousness, to use his word, out of every single bite.
Dan Pashman shares that wisdom in a new book called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. He joins us from our studios in New York. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Rachel.
You and I have had conversations about food before, and our Weekend Edition listeners are familiar with your food philosophy. But for the uninitiated, how about just explaining how you think about food?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that I consider a bite to be a precious resource. You know, like, you only get so many. You only get so many in every meal and in every life. And so you should strive to make every single one as delicious as possible. And I mean everyone, even if it's the most pedestrian meal, even if it's just that sandwich you grabbed at the lunch counter in your 5-minute break, there's probably something you can do to make it a little bit better. And I think that when you can do that, that's an exciting, fun, delicious moment. Like, you can achieve greatness even in the most modest culinary circumstances.
These are big promises that you've laid out, achieving greatness.
That's right.
So let's break this down. You have written this book with a lot of technical explanations about getting the most pleasure from your food. Let's walk through a couple of these. First off, the sandwich. There's a lot to say about this, but
there
you...
is. I don't know how much time we have for this interview, Rachel, but you might need to blow out the rest of the show.
Let's narrow it down to one aspect. You say construction of a sandwich is really actually very important.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Rachel, this has probably happened to you. You spend time building a beautiful sandwich, or you order a beautiful sandwich and it comes to you looking pristine and you are so excited to eat it, and you pick it up and you chomp your teeth into it. And what's the worst possible thing that could happen in that moment?
The insides fall out.
That's right.
Oh, really? Oh, I got an answer.
Yeah. I mean, these things keep me awake at night. But there are ways to avoid that cruel fate. And one is to give a lot of thought to the interior layering of your components and watch out for slippery components like sliced cucumbers, tomatoes, and avocados. I've identified this as something called the sliced cucumber conundrum.
So do you recommend keeping those ingredients off a sandwich?
Well, no. There's a few things you can do. You can use a technique I call the silver lining of greens, where you spread the greens, thin layers of greens between each layer to create friction. But the other thing to take into account is the hardness or crustiness of the bread. Because the more bite force that's required to pierce the outside of the sandwich, the more pressure you're exerting on the inside. So if you're going to have very slippery interior ingredients, you want softer bread.
All right. I'm with you. Next up, situational eating.
Yes.
Some advice on how to eat well at work is something you explore in this book. What are the pitfalls?
Well, the first pitfall of eating at work is we've all been in that situation. 3 or 4 o'clock rolls around, and you're feeling a little sleepy, and you head for some sugar in the form often of the office vending machine.
Yes.
Which can be, for many people, a bleak place to end up at 3 or 4 o'clock. But I think that even that seemingly bleak moment, you know, like, there's an opportunity there to do something fun and creative and find deliciousness. For instance, there's a recipe in the book for something called Cube Farm Tiramisu, which is a technique where you just take cookies from your office vending machine, uh-huh, soak them in the free office coffee, lay them on a platter, and refrigerate it for a bit. You could add some whipped cream if you want to get fancy, but it's really pretty delicious. It works especially well with like an Oreo or something with a cream filling.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's Cube Farm Tiramisu. I also have a whole vending machine decision tree in the book to help you decide what you want out of your vending machine in the office at a given time.
And what about on airplanes, which is a difficult situation to derive pleasure from food?
It is. You know, it's interesting. They've done studies that your taste buds are 30% less sensitive when you're in an airplane cabin because the air is so dry there that your taste buds dry up. So the first thing you got to do is add more flavor. So
you're talking about bringing your own food, first off, necessarily.
That's right. I mean, look. If you really want to travel well, bring food from outside the airport because, you know, it's slim pickings once you cross through security. But if you're in the plane, uh-huh, and you didn't get a chance to grab that sandwich, I think there's a couple of things you could do. One is to just always travel with what I call an in-flight saucetation device.
Okay, what
which is
that?
Like, you know those little plastic 3-ounce bottles that you can buy at the pharmacy? They're like for shampoo or conditioner, the
yeah,
travel bottles.
Yeah,
buy those. But instead, fill them with like sriracha, honey, soy sauce, hot sauce.
That is brilliant.
Throw them in your carry-on, and now you can just amp up whatever subpar meal they give you. The other thing is that while you're in the air, your taste bud sensitivity is reduced, but crunch sensitivity is increased. So crunchy foods taste crunchier when you're on a plane.
Is that for real?
Yes, the crunch will ring in your ears. It has to do with the hum of the airplane and the way that you process the sounds in your head. And so, like, when you get those free pretzels in the plane, if you're on a long flight and you're going to get a meal later, take the pretzels and save them and then crumble them over the entree. And that adds salt and flavor
salt,
and crunch.
A vehicle for salt. They never give me enough salt in those little packets.
That's what the pretzels are for.
Okay, so we've learned a lot here in this conversation. Any parting words of wisdom?
I mean, I talk in the book about how I feel like all of us have a lab in our own home. And it's called the kitchen. And there's great opportunity to experiment and try new things. And it's okay to fail as long as you're always striving for the platonic ideal of perfect deliciousness. And I think that's a noble quest. And I do honestly think, like, I think it's easy to dismiss all this as trivial. And certainly, you know, the book is fun and I hope that people find it entertaining. But I do think, like, I'm a big proponent of just the simple pleasures of life, and eating is one of the great universal simple pleasures. And when I wake up in the morning, no matter how crummy my day may look, if I got a good meal or two to look forward to, you know, the sun's shining.
There you go. Dan Pashman is the host of WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful. His new book is called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rachel.
Happy eating.
You too.
If you're one of the many addicts to the current crop of food shows, try this. Go to YouTube and watch a clip of Julia Child. It's like visiting a different planet.
Welcome to the French Chef. I'm Julia Child. Whenever you do French onion soup, you just need an awful lot of onions. And if you're going to have an awful lot of sliced onions, you've got to have a good sharp knife.
You kind of wonder how long she would last in the gladiator's arena that modern cooking shows have become.
Please pack your knives and go.
Today, two champions met in battle peanuts here in Kitchen Stadium.
We are about to chop this competition down to just three chefs.
Since the original Japanese Iron Chef first appeared on the Food Network here 15 years ago, how to cook shows have gradually been displaced by food combat, reality shows that pit chefs against each other. Krishnandu Ray is a professor of food studies at NYU's Steinhardt School. He says networks love these shows because they're cheap to produce, but they also reflect a changing audience.
Part of it is it's targeted towards young men, kind of a newer audience than the typical cooking show, which had an overwhelmingly female audience.
In terms of sheer numbers, though, more women are also watching these shows. They're really popular, right?
They are. And food has entered both the fashion cycle, I think, and a kind of a public discourse. A lot of things are driving it. One of the things that's new is this kind of an aesthetic approach to food, that you want to watch food, you want to talk about food. There's now room for people to argue about good taste, in a relatively much more democratic way than, say, high art or architecture. Those domains have been taken over much more extensively by experts.
It feels like it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about the rise of food porn. That's, you know, the cooking shows that luxuriated in the details of preparation. Is the day of food porn over now, replaced by food sports?
I never liked the phrase food porn. The discussion about food, beautiful pictures, good food, good taste, is drawing a lot of people into the discussion. And to use food porn is to dismiss that engagement. But there was also a rightful criticism about the fact that we are looking at basically just beautiful food and not worrying about all the labor that goes behind it. And all this public discussion of food is very good for celebrity chefs, is very good for people at the upper end of it, I would say 20% of that. But most of the 2 million cooks who cook for about $9, $10 an hour, this discussion hasn't touched or improved their lives at all.
Does any of this reflect people actually cooking less and ordering food more?
As Michael Pollan says, I think that what food TV does is trains you how to order in restaurants. I think the reason for people not cooking are kind of socioeconomic, demographic reasons. One is, of course, women escaping the kitchen. And the other part is people being very busy, long commutes, two jobs. Those are the reasons why people are not cooking.
I'm wondering if you've noticed the relationship between marketing of certain things and this trend with food shows. I mean, the way that pork bellies are popping up on this. It was one of these items that you have to use in a competition, and we're seeing these on menus.
Yeah, absolutely right. Food has entered the fashion cycle, and everybody has to deal with pork belly and then bacon in everything, and then everybody gets tired. So it has acquired a kind of a seasonal characteristic, which is one of the peculiar things when you, I think, mediatize something and commercialize something so proximate and domestic and care-based. And that's the price you pay for excessive discussion, I guess, of something.
Krishnandu Ray is an associate professor of food studies at NYU Steinhardt School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chocolate makers said today they are contributing several $100,000 to fight Ebola in West Africa. The companies include Nestle and Hershey's. They say they want to protect the world's largest suppliers of cocoa, Ghana and Ivory Coast. Now, to be clear, Ebola has not crossed over to those cocoa-producing countries, and yet Ebola has already affected the price of a chocolate bar even here in the United States. NPR's Gregory Warner has been asking why.
A few weeks ago, Jack Scoville was buying himself a chocolate bar, Hershey's milk, at a corner store in Chicago, and he noticed that the price was just a little bit higher, about 5 or 10 cents. His first thought was not to blame a greedy store owner or even the executives in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Scoville was blaming the West African Ebola virus.
Sure, it's occurred to me. I don't know that the average guy in the street would.
But Scoville is not your average chocolate eater. He's a senior market analyst at Price Futures Group looking at the cocoa commodities market. And last month, cocoa contracts, that is the price that, for instance, chocolate makers agree to pay for raw cocoa, spiked in large part on Ebola fears.
The price made the move to three-year highs in response to the Ebola crisis and fears that it could spread into Ivory Coast and Ghana.
Ivory Coast and Ghana together produce more than half the world's cocoa, and they're just next door to Ebola-affected countries Liberia and Guinea. Now, everyone I've interviewed for this story wants me to remind you that you cannot get Ebola from chocolate. The fear, rather, was that if Ebola jumped over the border to Ivory Coast, those cocoa farmers would scatter. The cocoa fruits, it's the seeds of the fruit that we call the cocoa bean, would stay unpicked, and Halloween would become as expensive as Christmas.
That would be the fear.
Or that was the fear until the end of September, when this fear, as with so many that seemed to petrify the markets, suddenly vanished. The price eased back, maybe because enough weeks had passed and Ebola hadn't jumped the border, or because Ivory Coast reassuringly locked down its land borders, allowing almost no human traffic from Ebola-affected countries.
The market feels like we've dodged a bullet.
But if you leave aside the markets and consider what is now happening on those cocoa farms as a result of those sealed borders, most of the workers that harvest cocoa in Ivory Coast are migrant workers from Liberia and Guinea, who now can't cross the border to pick that cocoa.
Well, we are at the critical phase of the season at the moment because the season starts at the beginning of October.
George Edward is head of group research for Ecobank, the Pan-African bank.
And if Côte d'Ivoire's agriculture sector loses all of its laborers, that will have a huge impact in terms of the crop and what can actually be harvested.
Ecobank researchers predict that farms will procure pod pickers from elsewhere, but they cannot be sure how the season will go. And the reason that they're not sure is also a second-order impact of Ebola. See, usually at this time you'd have swarms of agronomists sent by chocolate companies into West Africa to literally count trees and pods on the trees, and use mathematical modeling to predict, to great accuracy, the world's supply of cocoa this year. But because of Ebola, many of those pod counters never boarded the plane, even to Ebola-free Ivory Coast and Ghana.
Without having the agronomists there now, a lot of the trips have been cancelled. They just don't want to send the Europeans to the region, even in areas that are not infected with Ebola. That means this information is not coming in. So this entire cocoa season, we could be walking in the dark.
So let me ask my most important question. Should I stock up on, 200 chocolate bars just in case?
Yes, actually. Well, it doesn't necessarily keep that well. So I don't know, unless you're going to eat 200 chocolate bars in a couple of months.
To put this in perspective, though, if cocoa prices do spike, it means people will eat less chocolate. When migrant workers aren't able to reach the fields and send those wages home because the borders are locked down, that means some families won't eat at all. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.